Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. We're reading this morning from the October 9th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a smiling President Trump sitting at a desk. On the blotter in front of him, there's a little piece of paper that says, I owe you $421 million. And then he's got three golden cups that he has turned upside down, and he looks like he's playing the classic shell game. Con game, moving things around. Beside the blotter on the desk is a picture of a smiling Ivanka Trump. And the title is Shell Game. Trump's tax returns reveal how he stiffed the IRS and amassed a mountain of debt. That is our first main story, and we will start right there. Trump's taxes, massive losses, and looming debts. What happened? In a blockbuster story on Donald Trump's long-hidden tax returns, the New York Times revealed this week that the president is deeply mired in debt and has, over the past 18 years, claimed massive business losses while paying next to nothing in federal income tax. Working from extensive tax data provided by an unrevealed source, the paper reported that Trump paid only $750 in federal income tax in both 2016 and 2017, and in 11 of the 16 prior years, paid no federal income tax at all. To reduce his tax bill, Trump wrote off not only hundreds of million dollars in business losses, including $315 million hemorrhaged by his golf courses, but extensive personal expenses he claimed as business deductions, including the cost of private planes and $70,000 in hairstyling for his television appearances. Trump also deducted $26 million in unspecified consulting fees, and in one case appeared to funnel nearly $750,000 to his daughter Ivanka as a consultant, even though she was an executive at his organization. During the period in question, Trump drew the bulk of his income from selling his image as a self-made billionaire on the reality show The Apprentice and through endorsements, even as his hotels, conference centers, and golf courses ran deeply in the red. The Times revealed that the cash-strapped president owes some $421 million on personally guaranteed loans that largely fell due within 4 years and whose creditors are unknown. He's battling the IRS over $72.9 million refund he claimed in 2010 that was subject to an audit. If he loses the judgment with interest, he may owe more than $100 million. Trump's tax data paint a picture, the Times reporters wrote, of a businessman president in a tightening financial vice. Trump dismissed the report as totally fake news. He repeated an oft-made claim that he can't release his tax returns because they're under audit, an assertion with no legal basis. I paid a lot, he said. It will all be revealed. Democrats seized on the story, which Representative Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, chair of an oversight subcommittee, said confirms that Trump is a cheat, a fraud, and perhaps the worst businessman in the world. What the editorial said. Now we know why Trump didn't want to release his tax return, said the Los Angeles Times. Instead of a genius deal maker, Trump has been revealed as a con man setting up a three-card Monte table in Times Square to fleece the gullible. The report makes one other thing clear. The U.S. tax code is rigged to benefit game players at the expense of average taxpayers. What laws were broken, asked the Wall Street Journal. It's hardly a scandal that Trump legally exploited the tax code to lower his tax bill. Congress has littered the code with loopholes aimed at assisting real estate businesses, among others, and Trump has made no secret of putting them to use. Democrats lard the tax code with these legal dodges to please their corporate donors and then selectively attack CEOs or businesses that use them. What the columnist said, Trump is either a tax fraud or the world's worst businessman, said Ellie Mistel in the WashingtonPost.com. Trump's returns show he blew the $435 million made from his apprentice run and licensing deals on terrible new purchases, proving he's as bad at running his businesses as he is in running the country. It's also possible that he's defrauded the government. There's plenty here, including Ivanka's consulting fees and Trump's claim that a family compound was a business expense that points to felony tax evasion. Trump's foreign entanglements are most alarming of all, said Timothy Carney in WashingtonExaminer.com. He reportedly earned $73 million from overseas businesses his first 2 years as president, including $3 million from the Philippines and $1 million from Turkey. Both countries are run by brutal strongmen known for their offenses against human rights. Trump speaks glowingly of both and is reaping these millions with their tacit approval. If U.S. foreign policy upset them, what might happen to those profits? The Times report backs up what his former lawyer Michael Cohen told us, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. As his apprentice money began to dry up, Trump ran for president to revive his flagging fortunes. When he unexpectedly won, he set about leveraging the presidency for every dollar he could. Now he's desperate to stay in office so he can avoid prosecution and prison. Worst of all, there's a time bomb of debt in Trump's near future, said David Atkins in WashingtonMonthly.com. He owes more than $400 million with no means of repaying it, and we don't know who holds his IOUs. Whoever they are, they have the capacity to be directly dictating to Donald Trump, and he would be in no position to say no. The possibility that bad actors might hold that kind of leverage over a U.S. president is beyond comprehension. Controversy of the week, Amy Coney Barrett. What are her judicial beliefs? Republicans' shamelessness is ramming through a Supreme Court nominee this close to the election is bad enough, said Barbara McQuaid in NYMag.com. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's hypocritical power play will be even harder for liberals to swallow, since President Trump's nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, is a far-right conservative more extreme than Antonin Scalia. Barrett, who will likely replace the late feminist champion Ruth Bader Ginsburg, belonged to a Notre Dame law school group called Faculty for Life, and at 48 could sit on the court for the next half century. Like Scalia, Barrett is both a legal originalist and a devout Catholic, said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com. Your legal career is but a means to an end, building the kingdom of God, she told a graduating class at Notre Dame. More than any nominee in memory, Barrett has openly endorsed the view that justices can overturn established legal precedent, writing in 2013 that it's more legitimate for a judge to enforce her best understanding of the Constitution rather than a precedent she thinks clearly in conflict with it. Her presence on a 6-3 conservative court may put Roe v. Wade on the chopping block, along with other hard-won rights and protections, from same-sex marriage to laws on guns and discrimination. Democrats are in a tough spot, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. Now a federal appeals court judge, Barrett earned a reputation for legal brilliance as a summa cum laude student and then a professor at Notre Dame. A Kavanaugh-style personal attack on the likable, hard-working mother of seven children, two of them adopted from Haiti and one with special needs, could backfire disastrously with women. Catholics, and evangelical Christians in the looming election. Nor is Barrett a judicial radical, said Adam Friedman in NYPost.com. She would probably vote to uphold state abortion restrictions, but is on record saying that overturning Roe is very unlikely, given the disruption it would cause. Don't be fooled, said Ellie Mistel in TheNation.com. Barrett would not disappoint conservatives when it comes to abortion. In an article about Catholic judges and death penalty, she argued that she cannot, and more important, should not enforce secular laws that go against her religious beliefs. At Barrett's earliest opportunity, Roe is toast. So probably is the Affordable Care Act, said Ronald Brownstein in TheAtlantic.com. In 2012, Barrett accused Chief Justice John Roberts of distorting the ACA beyond its plausible meaning to uphold the law's constitutionality. Democrats are planning to focus on the health care law during her confirmation hearings, which could really work in swing states where millions of Americans rely on Obamacare for coverage. Democrats hope that Republicans filling Ginsburg's seat with a right-wing ideologue so close to the election will turn off independent and moderate voters and give Democrats control of the Senate. The rush to install Barrett before November 3rd is all about the election, said Amanda Carpenter in TheBulwark.com. So that should be the Democrats' focus. Trump and his allies have been brazenly upfront about their belief that Barrett should be confirmed to resolve any disputes over the 2020 elections in Trump's favor. Democrats should ask her if she'll recuse herself from that case. They should also press for her views on past voting rights cases about Bush versus Gore, the 2000 ruling in which five conservative justices cut off a recount in Florida. Will Barrett reward Trump by giving him a second term? That's the biggest question facing her. In our Good Week, Bad Week segment, it was a good week for making stuff up after a federal judge threw out a defamation suit against Fox News host Tucker Carlson, agreeing with the network's lawyers that no reasonable viewer takes what he says seriously. It was a good week for finders keepers after a visitor to the Crater of Diamonds State Park in Arkansas found a 9-carat raw diamond lying on the ground. It looked kind of interesting and shiny, said Kevin Kennard, 33, adding he honestly teared up when informed his find was the second largest diamond in park history. Getting a bigger boat, it was a good week for. After four Arkansas alligator hunters caught a record-breaking 13-foot, 11-inch, 800-pound gator. It drug the boat around for almost 2 hours, said hunter Travis Bearden. But it was a bad week for feedback after U.S. citizen Wesley Barnes faced years in a Thai jail for posting negative TripAdvisor reviews about a resort there. Under Thailand's strict anti-defamation laws, Barnes' comments about the resort's unfriendly staff could result in 2 years behind bars. It was a bad week for school kids with the news that by entrenching remote learning, the pandemic may make snow days a thing of the past. Philadelphia teacher Dennis Anglim says kids may never again feel the excitement of waking up at 5 a.m. and looking at the ticker at the bottom of the television to see if your school will be closed. Finally, it was a bad week for the will of the people. After Ayaan Alaman was overwhelmingly elected to a third term as mayor of the Romanian village of Deveselu, despite having died of COVID-19 10 days earlier. Alaman may be dead, said his deputy Nicolae Dobre, but none of the other contenders got the same trust from the voters. We're on the briefing page. the Trump agenda for a second term. What the president says he will do if he's reelected. Next week, the Biden agenda. Donald Trump has broken the mold as president, and that extends to his second term agenda. In August, the Republican Party dispensed with long-standing tradition and did not formulate a policy platform, instead issuing a statement declaring that the party will enthusiastically support the president's America First agenda. The Trump campaign later issued a list of core priorities for a second term, offered in bullet points that included build the world's greatest infrastructure system and stop endless wars, but did not offer any detail about how it would achieve them. Still, Trump's stated priorities and his first-term record offer a sense of what policies he might pursue in a second term. COVID-19. Trump has suggested repeatedly that we are rounding the corner of the pandemic and that the coronavirus may just go away on its own. He has declined to have the federal government take an active role in building a testing system or putting in place other public health measures, telling states that the response is their own responsibility. He has been a vocal opponent of state lockdown efforts, remote schooling, and other social distancing measures aimed at stemming viral spread, and has questioned the value of wearing face masks. Recently, he has focused on developing a vaccine and initiated the public-private partnership Operation Warp Speed to fast-track vaccine development, manufacture, and distribution. He has pledged that a vaccine will be available within months, maybe even before a special date. Experts involved in the vaccine efforts say that's unlikely. Taxes. Trump campaigned in 2016 on a platform of lowering taxes, and he delivered with the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which lowered the corporate tax rate and cut income tax rates across the board, with most of the benefits going to corporations and upper-income earners. Extending those cuts, which are slated to expire in 2025, would almost certainly be a second-term priority. Trump has said he may pursue a reduction in capital gains taxes and additional tax cuts for middle-income families. By executive order, Trump deferred the collection of payroll taxes for many workers through the end of the year, and he has vowed to eliminate the payroll tax, which funds Social Security and Medicare, if he is reelected. But Congress has shown no interest in eliminating the tax. Health care. Trump's health care plan could be best described as a plan to make a plan. He vowed in his first term to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, an effort that failed in Congress, and has continually promised that he will unveil a health care plan that will cost less than Obamacare while offering better coverage. But he has never released such a plan, even as his administration has joined a lawsuit by 20 Republican-led states seeking to repeal the ACA as unconstitutional, which will reach the Supreme Court in November. If the lawsuit succeeds, at least 21 million Americans will lose their coverage. Last week, Trump issued an executive order stating that the estimated 133 million Americans with pre-existing conditions should be protected from losing their health insurance. He offered no specifics on how that might be achieved if Obamacare is revoked. Climate change and the environment. Trump moved early in his first term to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement and maintains that the science on climate change is unsettled. His administration has aggressively pursued rollbacks of environmental protections, rollbacks that have benefited the fossil fuel industry by weakening fuel efficiency standards for cars, loosening limits on power plant emissions, and opening up public lands for gas and oil extraction. In his second term, Trump has promised he will continue his deregulatory agenda for energy independence. Education. Trump has said that education will be a big factor for me in his second term, and he's a strong proponent of school choice. His administration has pushed policies favoring charter schools and vouchers, which allow families to use tax dollars for private school tuition. And he has promised to rescue kids from failing schools by helping their parents send them to a safe school of their choice. He has proposed a $5 billion tax credit that would reimburse private donations to state-based scholarship funds. The economy. Trump embarked on a trade war with China in his first term, imposing tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars in imports. Aiding the American economy by reducing our dependence on China is a key focus of his second-term agenda. He has promised to pass tax credits for companies that shift operations from China to the U.S., deny federal contracts to companies that move jobs there, and increase deductions for essential industries like pharmaceuticals and robotics who bring back their manufacturing to the United States. Trump's foreign policy. Trump has pursued an America First doctrine that has led to a cooling of relations with long-standing allies, curtailment of international cooperation, and calls to reduce overseas troop deployments. He has questioned the worth of international alliances such as NATO, which he says relies too heavily on U.S. defense spending, and the World Trade Organization, and has announced his intent to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization. He also pulled out of the nuclear deal President Obama struck with Iran, pursuing economic sanctions that he predicts will force Tehran back to the negotiating table. He has made the Middle East a priority and successfully brokered deals to establish diplomatic ties between Israel and two Arab nations, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And he has taken a much friendlier approach to Russia than previous administrations, communicating regularly with Russian President Vladimir Putin and pushing last summer to readmit Russia to the G7 group of Western nations. Trump has declined to confront Putin over Moscow's interference in the 2016 and 2020 elections or its offering of bounties to Taliban militants for killing U.S. troops in Afghanistan. "I like Putin. He likes me," Trump said last week. "We get along." Read a few of the best columns. We'll start with one from the U.S. Should liberals give up on Roe? Are progressives too focused on protecting Roe versus Wade? Asked law professor Joan Williams. The question may seem shocking, but the reality is that we've basically lost the abortion fight. If Roe is overturned, access to abortion will depend on where you live. But that is already true. There is no abortion clinic in 90% of U.S. counties as a result of Republican legislatures' death by a thousand cut strategies, imposing punitive restrictions on clinics and women seeking to end pregnancies. If Amy Coney Barrett replaces Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the court, the conservative majority is likely to approve even more state restrictions and perhaps overturn Roe. Progressives should remember that RBG herself decided that Roe was a mistake, a turning point in which the gradual liberalization of state abortion laws gave way to an all-consuming cultural struggle. Opposition to Roe has led tens of millions of Americans to support Republican candidates whose economic policies heavily favor the rich. Diffusing this culture war must occur through dialogue and persuasion. In heavily Catholic Ireland, young people knocked on granny's doors and persuaded them to legalize abortion. The same may need to happen here on a state-by-state basis. This is from the UK. When Kent becomes a car park. The people of Kent did overwhelmingly vote to leave the European Union in the Brexit referendum, said Faye Chopin. But we didn't vote to leave the UK. Yet now the government tells us there will effectively be a border between our county in the southeast of England, home to the entrance of the Eurotunnel and several major ferry ports, and the rest of the country. When the UK leaves the single market next January 1st, the government expects traffic jams stretching up to 100 miles on the highways leading to English Channel ports as French officials check cargo truckers' export documents. A particular worry, heightened by the pandemic, is that locals trying to drive to a hospital will get stuck in backups. So to smooth things, the government will make truck drivers obtain a Kent access permit that shows their papers are in order. Vast lorry parks will also be created in our towns where thousands of trucks will idle as they wait to gain access to ferries or the tunnel. The sight of all that tarmac will be depressing. The scent of all that exhaust, disgusting. We're supposed to be the garden of England, says lawmaker Rosie Duffield, but we're going to be the car park of England. Kent, as a polluted, cut-off enclave, is not what we expected from Brexit. From Canada, we have the lure of guaranteed income. Canadians are getting mighty comfortable with receiving money for nothing, said Nadine Youssef. When hundreds of thousands lost their jobs through the pandemic, the government created the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, a $1,500 a month boost for people whose income has been affected by the coronavirus. A staggering 22% of the population has applied for this economic salve, which has reignited the slow-burning debate over a universal basic income, or UBI. Such a safety net, Canadians are finding, is useful in catching not only coronavirus unfortunates, but also people desperate to transition out of struggling industries like oil and gas. Petroleum engineer Mark Taylor, for example, is using the payments to prepare for a new career in policing. Once opposed to government assistance, he now favors a basic income. And he's not alone. Some 62% of Canadians now approve of UBI, up from 46% in 2013. Conservatives oppose the idea, saying that all this free money will rob people of the motivation to work. But their concerns may be moot. Canadians might well decide that UBI's annual price tag of up to $150 billion is prohibitive. After all, the same proportion that supports basic income also says we shouldn't raise taxes one penny to pay for it. The last word, our in-depth article, looks a little different this week. We'll see. It's called The Cello Chase. Concert cellist Christine Valeska's stolen childhood instrument disappeared for almost 40 years, said Stacy Perman in the Los Angeles Times. Then a surprise email offered an unexpected chance to get it back. It was September 14th, 2013, when a mysterious email bearing the subject line, "Is this your first cello?" landed in Christine Valeska's inbox. The renowned cello virtuoso, however, checked her emails infrequently. Valeska prefers more personal contact. Decades spent touring the world had taught her that you could really only take the full measure of someone's intentions by speaking with them. Also, she didn't like to type. And so 6 months passed before she clicked on the missive sent by strangers living in Chico, California. "Maybe you will recognize this cello," the note read, describing the instrument made by the 19th century French luthier Auguste Sébastien Philippe Bernardel. Three photographs were attached. Valeska scanned the first two, showing the front and back of the instrument. When she pulled up the third, her heart nearly leaped from her chest. The image revealed the luthier's label, visible through one of the curlicued F-holes. Across it was a note inscribed in the feathery pen of the master himself. Pour la petite Countess Marie, 1834. For the little Countess Marie. I could hardly believe it, she recalled. The cello had been given to her as a child by her father nearly 40 years earlier. It had been stolen. Custom made for the daughter of a French aristocrat 2 centuries ago, it was a spectacular, rare 1/8 size cello produced by Bernardel, protege of Nicolas Lupeau, violin maker to King Louis XVIII. Can you imagine, she gasped in disbelief, my precious little Bernardel had surfaced after all these years. More than just her first cello, it was my first love. And she had grieved its loss as one does. She never forgot it. Valevska responded to the email with alacrity. Please phone me as soon as you can. Anxiously awaiting your phone contact. Valevska had originally set her sights on the violin. At 7, she studied with her mother, Marion, a conductor and music teacher, but she chafed under her overbearing tutelage. Frustrated, Valevska tore up her sheet music, and so that was the end of the violin. A year later, a French dealer offered the Bernardel to her father, Herman Valecki, an internationally respected dealer of fine and rare classical instruments in Los Angeles. He presented the little cello to her in 1953. She was 8 1/2. I kissed it, she recounted, from the living room of her Manhattan apartment overlooking Central Park. On a wall hangs an oil portrait of her as a young girl playing the Bernardel. From that first moment, I wanted to be a great cellist. My parents never had to ask me to practice. The earliest cellos date to the 16th century. They are soulful, vibrating instruments. The music swells and recedes on a tide of bow strokes. The composer Ernest Bloch likened the cello's sound to a human voice, vaster and deeper than any spoken language. But it is also a large instrument. From the tip of the scroll to the bottom, a cello measures 4 feet long, obliging players to sit down and cradle it. By necessity, a child learns to play on a scaled-down instrument. But few masters produced superbly crafted instruments for children. My father was a smart man, Valevska said. He knew that many of these children's parents say, well, I'll buy them a cheap instrument, and if they do well, then I can buy a better instrument. He realized the great value of a child falling in love with the sound of the instrument. Herman, the son of royal cabinet makers from England, opened Westwood Musical Instruments in 1947 and catered to its diverse and luminous population of professionals and students. His arrival coincided with a golden age in classical music in Los Angeles. Herman, Valevska said with a note of pride, sold more Stradivarius instruments in the last 10 years of his life than all of the other dealers in the world put together. The family's home frequently played host to the city's finest musicians. During those gatherings, Valevska often performed on the Bernardel. When Ennio Bologhini, the great Argentine cellist, and his wife heard Valevska play, she whispered in her ear, "This little girl is going to be a great cellist." He whispered back, "She already is." At 12, Valevska performed the haunting Saint-Saëns Concerto with the National Symphony. At 18, she became the first American to win the first prize in cello and chamber music at the Paris Conservatory. The pianist Arthur Rubinstein described her as having the most sensuous tone I have ever heard on the cello. She is the only cellist who takes my breath away. Still, she remained stubbornly attached to the Bernardel. Herman mounted the little cello on a wall in his store, telling her, "You will hand this down to your daughter and her child after that." When Herman died in 1967, his son Fred took over the music shop and transformed it into a rock and roll mecca. the place where everyone from the Beach Boys to the Rolling Stones went to buy guitars and had them repaired. Then one day in 1976, two men in their 30s walked into the store. "Wow, what a far-out store," Fred remembered one of them saying. "You must have a lot of expensive things. What are the most valuable?" Without thinking, Fred immediately pointed to his sister's cello on the wall, as well as a custom-made guitar with mother-of-pearl inlay. That night, after closing, the store's windows were smashed, setting off the alarm. By the time the police arrived, the cello and the guitar were gone. In 2011, Dustin Brashears was a young piano teacher managing Chico's Youth Orchestra, living with his wife Julie and their three young children. He always brought the kids to the orchestra's weekly rehearsals, and two were drawn to the violin, Dustin Jr., then four, and Valerie, the youngest, at two. But three-year-old Starla gravitated to the cello. "I liked that it was big, and it just sounded so much nicer than the squeaky violin," said Starla, now 12. "I don't remember asking my parents. I just wanted to play." All three were gifted. "Not only were they technically perfect, but they played with feeling," said Dawn Harms, who sits on the music faculty at Stanford University and began teaching them at the San Francisco Conservatory. "They literally tell a story." Despite the family's modest finances, when Starla turned four, her parents began searching for a fine, antique, 1/8 size cello. The Brashearses refused to settle for a Chinese factory-made one. "Everybody just thought I was ridiculous," Dustin recalled. After a year of searching, Julie heard from a Los Angeles dealer named Georg Ettinger, who said he had just the instrument. It was made in 1834 by the luthier Bernadelle, and, as far as he knew, hadn't been played for at least 30 years. Ettinger told them he would only consider lending it out if there was a student of exceptional ability. He said he needed to hear Starla play. So the family set out to meet him at the shop that Ettinger had purchased in 2004 from Hans Weishaar, a buyer, seller, and restorer of stringed instruments. The Brashearses packed up the family, which had by then expanded to five children, there would be six in all, and drove 12 hours through the night, arriving on the afternoon of September 7th, 2013. Oblivious to the adults, Starla, wearing a pink party dress with a white ribbon in her hair, sat down in a folding chair and placed the tiny cello between her legs. It was nearly as big as she was. For 2 hours, she tore through her repertoire: Bach's Cello Suite No. 1, concertos by Gero Goltermann and Jean-Baptiste Bereval. Ettinger and the Brashears made an arrangement. The family would rent the instrument for $150 a month. Starla fell in love with the little Bernadelle immediately. "It felt like part of me." Julie found the label intriguing. "I thought it was crazy that this belonged to a countess and nobody knows about it." So she searched the internet looking for clues. When she typed in Bernadelle and "Pour la petite Comtesse Marie 1834, she came across an interview that Christine Walewska had done with the Internet Cello Society. The Brashears decided to reach out to her. They typed up an email, attached three photos, and waited. It was shortly after Walewska's birthday, March 18, 2014, when she spoke to the Brashears. Walewska bristled when they told her that the Bernadelle came from the Hans Weismer shop. Weismer, she remembered, was a not-so-friendly competitor of her father's. Before they ended the phone call, Dustin told her, "You should have your cello back." "We've got to figure out how to handle this properly," she replied. The Brashears sent Walewska videos of Starla playing the cello, and as she watched Starla perform, Walewska saw herself. "I knew immediately she was a big talent," she said. "This little girl's name, Starla, is well chosen." Walewska told the Brashears that Starla should continue to play the Bernadelle until she was ready to move onto a larger instrument. Once that day came, she would contact the police. Until then, she cautioned everyone to keep its existence to themselves. As 2015 drew to a close, it was time. Dustin Brashears informed Valevska that Starla was ready to move up to a one-quarter size cello. While still in New York, she dispatched her nephew to visit the LAPD's West LA division to get the ball rolling. Valevska needed to show that the cello was indeed the same instrument stolen from Westwood Musical Instruments. Secondly, she had to prove she was its legal owner. The LAPD assigned Detective Don Hyrick, who ran the art theft detail, to the case. Hyrick, who had once worked homicide in South Los Angeles' 77th Street Division, had emerged as the country's only metropolitan cop dedicated to art crimes. Over the course of his career, Hyrick hunted down stolen Picassos, found the Scarecrow's tap shoes from the Wizard of Oz, and retrieved O.J. Simpson's Heisman Trophy. He had also proved proficient in the niche specialty of rare instruments. Hyrick spent 6 months attempting to reconstruct what happened. The 1976 police report couldn't be found, and the detective had just Valevska's word that the instrument had been stolen, and a mountain of photographs and testimonials. The detective didn't put a lot of stock in Valevska's theory that her father and Weishar's rivalry might have played a part. He thought the cello might have been traded hands multiple times before it wound up with Weishar. I think that if he had any crooked intentions, he wouldn't have prominently displayed it at his violin shop, he said. Still, Hyrick was fairly certain the Bernardelle belonged to Valevska, even if under the law she couldn't prove it. He suggested she make the case to Ettinger herself, in person. By then, it was the summer of 2016. Valevska arranged with the Brashears to fly to Los Angeles and arrive at the shop right after they returned Bernardelle in August. Fairly quickly, Valevska sized up that Ettinger knew nothing about the theft. He was presented with all of this information, which was a shock to him. Then she made her appeal. I said, "You know this can be a win-win situation for you because it speaks highly of you to cooperate and return the cello to its rightful owner." The two had a private conversation, and within days, Valevska provided more documents at his request and to his satisfaction. They took a photograph of the two of them and the cello. "I gave him a kiss on the cheek," she said. As happy endings go, this might suitably have ended right there. But in many ways, this is where the story begins. When Valevska met Starla for the first time, Valevska hugged her and called her "my little star." She now referred to the cello as "our little Bernardelle." Valevska got her cello and a protege. Starla got a mentor and a friend. Valevska estimates that there have been five great female cellists. "My belief is that this little girl could be in line to be the sixth." Starla says her dream is to play a duet with Valevska, but she hasn't mustered up the courage yet to ask. A version of this story originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times. We're on the health and science page. Here's a short article titled "Arctic Sea Ice Near Record Low." With temperatures continuing to rise at the top of the world, Arctic sea ice this summer shrank to its second lowest level on record. The minimum extent was likely reached on September 15th, with 1.44 million square miles covered in sea ice, about 1 million square miles fewer than the 1981 to 2010 average. In four decades of satellite measurements of sea ice, only 2012 had a lower minimum, when 1.32 million square miles of ocean were covered in sea ice. It's been a crazy year up north, with sea ice at near record low, 100-degree heat waves in Siberia, and massive forest fires, Mark Cerise, director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center, tells the New York Times. We are headed toward a seasonally ice-free Arctic Ocean. Arctic sea ice hits its maximum coverage in fall and winter and melts in spring and summer. Declining sea ice creates what scientists call a feedback loop for global warming. The ice reflects most of the sunlight that strikes it, whereas the ocean's darker surface absorbs more of the sun's rays and re-emits that energy as heat. So when ice melts and exposes more ocean, it leads to more warming, which in turn means more ice loss. Coffee versus colorectal cancer. People with advanced colorectal cancer may have a better chance of survival if they drink coffee, reports USA Today. Researchers studied 1,171 patients who had the disease and could not be treated with surgery over an average follow-up period of 5 years. Compared with those who drank no coffee, the patients who had a cup a day had an 11% increased survival rate and a 5% increased rate of living progression-free, meaning their cancer didn't get worse. Those who drank four or more cups a day fared even better, with a 36% jump for overall survival and 22% for non-progression. The reason for this apparent link is unclear. Caffeine doesn't seem to play a role. The effect was the same for decaf and regular coffee. But some compounds in coffee are known to have anti-inflammatory properties. Study co-author Dr. Kimmy Ng from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston says that while it would be premature to recommend coffee as a treatment for colorectal cancer, drinking coffee is not harmful and may potentially be beneficial. And we'll go on over to the Talking Points page. We'll start with the election, how Trump plans to challenge the results. America, this is not a drill, said John Avlon in CNN.com. President Trump just told us our democracy is at risk. From him, when asked during a White House briefing last week, will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transfer of power after the election? Trump's reply was chilling. Well, we're going to have to see what happens, he said, before repeating his unfounded contention that mail-in balloting will result in widespread fraud. Get rid of the ballots, he said, and you'll have a very. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. All of this came as The Atlantic quoted a campaign legal advisor as promising that millions of mail-in ballots counted after the polls closed November 3rd will be challenged as being inaccurate, fraudulent, pick your word. Barring a Joe Biden landslide, an unprecedented constitutional crisis is inevitable, said Philip Rucker in the Washington Post. Trump told Fox News that the mailed ballots would create a horror show that he will challenge in court, and that he'd only concede if his newly refashioned Supreme Court, with a 6-3 conservative majority, ruled in Biden's favor. We want to make sure the election is honest, Trump said, and I'm not sure that it can be. Trump is telling us that he knows he can't win at the ballot box, said Aaron Rippar in Vox.com. Polls show him trailing Biden by about 7% nationally and by varying amounts in key swing states. The president is hoping for a repeat of 2000 when a conservative Supreme Court majority cut off a recount in Florida and gave George W. Bush the presidency, despite his having lost the popular vote. Trump's plan has a big flaw, said Ben Mathis Lilly in Slate.com. The Supreme Court's conservatives might be willing to intervene if the margin between the two candidates is a razor-thin 537 votes in one state, as it was in 2000. But overturning clear election results in a host of swing states may be a bridge too far even for a post-Ginsburg court. Nullifying millions of votes would severely undermine both Trump's and the court's perceived legitimacy and probably would provoke national unrest. That wouldn't stop Trump, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. He has repeatedly expressed admiration for dictators who respond to uprisings with strong crackdowns. Attorney General William Barr will likely announce some kind of investigation to provide official cover for Trump to declare himself the winner on or just after Election Day. That will give Trump and a Republican legal team time to invalidate mail-in balloting on an unprecedented scale. The legal battle to come may make 2000 look like a mere skirmish, said Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker. Republicans plan to challenge mail-in ballots on a variety of grounds. Late postmarks, questionable signature matches, and ballot collection or harvesting by activists. America has advanced world's most decentralized election system, with 10,500 separate voting jurisdictions and each state holding its own separate contest with unique rules and procedures. Throw in real or rumored election interference by Russia or China, and the potential for weeks of chaos and violence in the streets is high. The idea that Trump would overstay his term is nothing but Democratic hysteria, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. After Trump's admittedly intemperate remarks last week, both the GOP-controlled Senate and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reaffirmed their commitment to a peaceful transition on January 20th. Trump will have no choice but to leave if he loses. Biden, however, has joined other Democrats in claiming Trump plans to steal the election. Who's really plotting the coup? Let's look at the evidence, said Suzanne Gomba in NBCNews.com. In Trump's first term, he dismantled myriad checks on his power. He's muffled scientists from the Centers for Disease Control for contradicting his talking points on the pandemic, hijacked the Justice Department to prosecute his enemies and defend his cronies, branded the media the enemy of the people, fired a host of inspectors general for investigating his aides, and filled key jobs with unqualified loyalists and family members. He used the White House as a prop for the Republican National Convention and steered millions in taxpayer and campaign funds into his own hotels and businesses. Americans who immigrated from Latin America say Trump reminds them of dictators who came to power by democratic means and then established themselves as authoritarian rulers for life. America, says Tony Jimenez, a Cuban-American who served as the George W. Bush administration, is in real peril of succumbing to Trumpismo. Breonna Taylor, was justice done? Those seeking justice for Breonna Taylor's death were denied it last week, said ZZ Packer in NewYorker.com. A Kentucky grand jury declined to bring murder charges against three Louisville police officers who broke down Taylor's door after midnight on March 13th and emptied 32 rounds into her apartment, killing her. Taylor, 26, an ebullient and bubbly EMT, became a rallying cry for the police reform movement. But Republican Attorney General Daniel Cameron said the officers, searching for evidence connected to Taylor's ex-boyfriend, Jamarcus Glover, an incarcerated drug dealer, were entitled to return fire after Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, fired a shot as they charged into the apartment. Who could fault Walker? Just one of 12 neighbors interviewed said they heard the cops identify themselves. Kentucky was right not to opt for mob justice, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Murder charges would have been grossly inappropriate for officers executing a legal search warrant. Taylor maintained ties to Glover, who was recorded saying he kept $14,000 of his drug money at her apartment. Detective Brett Hankinson, since fired, was rightly charged with wanton endangerment for blindly shooting 10 rounds into Taylor's apartment, though none hit her. The grand jury's decision was proper, said David French in the Dispatch.com, but it also highlights a dire need for reform. Supreme Court rulings have given police departments wide latitude to execute surprise, late-night, violent entries into private dwellings for the sole purpose of preserving evidence. Since many states allow citizens to use a firearm against intruders, a gun battle can commence with both parties acting completely lawfully. Taylor's death was not a tragedy for which no one is to blame, said Radley Balko in WashingtonPost.com. She died because of dereliction of duty by police. They did not know Walker was in the apartment, and he called 911 because he didn't know the invaders were cops. Police found no drugs or cash, and 20 minutes passed before Taylor received medical attention. Despite becoming a national cause celebre, said Zach Cheney Rice in New York Magazine, Taylor's case ended up, like so many others, with a black person dead and police unpunished. Clearly, the existing legal framework serves the police's interest over people like Breonna Taylor's. Here's a short note. California's historic wildfire season has thrown the state's winemaking industry into chaos as vineyards scramble to assess the extent to which smoke has contaminated their harvest. Noah Dorrance, owner of Reeve Wines, said that in every grape he sampled, you could already taste and smell this ashy barbecued flavor, kind of like a campfire. And we'll finish with a quote from J.M. Barrie. God gave us memory so that we might have roses in December. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.